This podcast is supported by Siemens, your partner for industrial-grade AI.
Hi there. Welcome to a new edition of the Industrial AI podcast. My name is Peter Seeberg, and I'm your host. Today, I'm going to be talking to Peter van Schalkwijk. He's the CEO of XMPro, and Peter and I are going to be talking about multi-agent generative systems for transforming industrial processes. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Peter. Nice to be on your podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Peter, the difference with my name is only one I, Peter, my Peter. Please introduce yourself to our listeners.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm Peter van Schalkwijk, and I'm the CEO at XMPro. My background's in engineering, so I spent quite a number of years on the factory floor and on the industrial side, and then decided to go to the dark side of IT. So I did some postgraduate studies on the IT side of things, and we're now seeing all of these things converge into kind of the digital engineer, where it's a combination of both of these skills. I am outside of XMPro, I'm also chair for a number of working groups and task groups in Digital Twin Consortium, in the Mining Guidelines group, and heading up things like AI and industrial AI task groups and working groups.
Okay, well, sounds great. Yeah, we're going to be concentrating on, I guess, on many of those, but we put industrial AI in the center there. Now, you started, that's already in the middle of last year, three quarters of a year ago, you started an article series on LinkedIn, and you started actually with railroads, and you finish with real-world applications of multi-agent generative systems. Now, let's jump in. What do railroads and multi-agent generative systems have in common?
A great question. And I think, you know, we've seen a number of evolutions of technology over since we've had Industry 1.0. And one of the things that we see every single time with those is that once a certain technology matures, it becomes a utility. And likewise with things like railroads, there was a lot of investment. It was quite unique in terms of how it started. And quite a number of organizations got involved. But through that, we built the infrastructure and we built the utility of being able to, for example, in the US, we're connecting the East Coast to the West Coast. And through that, all the trade and everything established along the routes of that. So it created that utility or the ability to now create new business models. And likewise, what we're seeing with specifically large language models, which is capturing everyone's attention. And just to kind of clarify, industrial AI is not just about generative AI. There are a number of different AI components that you could apply to it. Causal analysis, neurosymbolic AI, there are quite a few. But generative AI is the one that has really kind of moved us from kind of awareness to being right in front. And that attracted a lot of investment, a lot of work. And a number of organizations have built out capabilities on that. Now, what we're seeing with those capabilities, they're now becoming almost the utility that we now have. And likewise with railroads, where we went from a large number of organizations doing this, we started creating some standards. So everyone's on the same kind of rail tracks and the economy started building around it. The other reality of it is we only have a few large rail companies out there at the moment, so we don't have many, many small ones. But from a utility factor, we now have standardized connection between, for example, the East Coast and the West Coast in the US, and we've built this whole trade that sits around it. We see the same thing with generative AI. So it's not about, you know, which model is the best one. It's actually what can you do with it and how can you now create that utility and turn that into something from a business process or a way that you can now create new business models and advance through that. So that for us was kind of the analogy going from a lot of investment, heavy, complex, big, and only few players could do it, to where we have a whole ecosystem and a whole economy that could actually run through that. So that was the real benefit that came out of it. And likewise, we're seeing the same with generative AI.
Right. And if we stay with that comparison for a moment, where are we now then, as far as then Gen AI or the later on the multi-agent systems are concerned? Was the first railway track, was that Stockton, I believe, was that 1780 or was it 1880? I'm not sure. But where are we today then, if in that comparison?
So I think we're starting to see a consolidation of the larger utilities. So there are a number of big players, and there's still one or two trying to get into that space, but it's really hard for anyone now to kind of become a leader in creating the models or owning the models. And I think a number of organizations, even organizations like NVIDIA, have seen that the inference market, and that's why NVIDIA, for example, launched the NIMS, which is the inference models. So a lot of it is now moving to the utility. Likewise, with the electricity generation, we saw something similar where there were a whole bunch of organizations like GE and others who built a lot of power generation, but then they also started building the consumption of that. So the actual white goods, the washing machines and things like that, that consume that the power that came out of the power plants that were built, is actually where the growth of the opportunity sat with that. So likewise with the railroads, I think where we are now with these generative systems, I wouldn't get into the business of starting to build a model, but we are seeing the use of it or the utility. Again, if I go back to the example of the power station versus the washing machines and the electrical equipment and everything that market that has appeared around that, I think we're starting to see that market starting to understand what it means to actually consume that utility, because the real value actually only come from electricity, for example, when you can consume it and do something and make something with it rather than just have it. So likewise with large language models, it's great to play around with, I have to just name a few, ChatGPT, Claude, Grok, whatever you want to call, and ask it silly questions and make nice pictures. But from a business value and from a creating new business models, there's very little in that. It kind of sparks a little bit of our curiosity and creativity, but the real value and the utility from an industrial point of view is only when you can start applying it to real problems that we have in the industrial sector. And that's where agents and things are starting to emerge. So we've also seen there's a progression going from kind of decision support systems with a little bit of AI to decision augmentation, where I've got co-pilots and assistants, to what we're now starting to see, where organizations realize, well, I can actually build some automations, and some of those automations can be really clever, so they can have cognitive capability and kind of work like a brain. Others are almost brain dead, and they just kind of workflow with the LLM in, but they could still drive some utility or value for me around my business processes. So that's where we're starting to see these agents starting to fit in, is not at that bottom layer of trying to be the reasoning model, but at that level of I'm trying to build a smarter business process that will drive value.
Okay. We're going to be talking about all of those in detail. It's a great comparison. I had seen, most of us had heard about the comparison to electricity, maybe by Andrew Wang, I think, but the way that you put it, actually, I've been reading for a couple of hours. These days, for me, it's difficult to pick up a novel, even when I'm supposed to be on holiday, I think. But when I started reading in your article, and we're going to make the the links available in the show notes for you, dear listener. So why then, how do you see Gen AI introducing a new way of working other than, for example, blockchain?
I think blockchain is a completely, blockchain is a evolution of an existing kind of approach that we've had. So it's just improving almost the effectiveness, or sorry, the efficiency factor of what we were trying to do with making information immutable and secure and all of that. So that's kind of almost an evolutionary process that has happened. What we're seeing with generative AI, it's a completely different problem that it's solving. Or it's not just a better mousetrap, which is kind of what, for me personally, and there are great value in things like, even with agentic AI, sometimes you may want to use some blockchain to, again, make information immutable. But that's an evolutionary process. What we're seeing with Gen AI is not just a better mousetrap or a smarter way of automating simple processes. It brings a completely different capability to be able to drive in terms of the challenges that we see in organizations where there's a lack of skills, systems are getting really complex, organizations have to do more with less. So those kind of challenges are really hard just to say, well, I can put a technology like blockchain onto it, where with these agentic decision models that you can build, you can actually address all of those specific concerns. So it's a very different value proposition from a technology versus a completely different business model approach.
Okay, I hear one is, as from your perspective, more evolutionary, while the other one is, I guess, to say revolutionary, right?
Yeah, I think we always need to be careful about revolutionary, because quite often revolutions don't end in a good result. I actually like to think about it more. One is a continuation of what we've been doing in the past, and it's growing in that. This is a completely different way of solving a problem. So I'm not telling you to build a better mousetrap. I'm giving you a completely different way of solving something, which has been really hard. And through our incremental processes of trying to do some of the improvements we have in the past, we actually didn't get to the OEE on the factory floor. We didn't get to pick up the maintenance issues because our engineers have been overloaded. They can't process all the information. There's just too much. There's pressures to cut costs. All of those requires a completely different way of addressing the problem. And I think that's what the agentic capabilities of generative AI brought us.
Right. Now we can sense through the microphone, through my headset, your excitement about Gen AI. Why don't you maybe start explaining, telling us what, as far as you're concerned, is a generative agent? How will it change, as you said, the way that we work? How can it help us?
Again, we're not, in terms of how our factories and industrial applications and AI and things like that work, it's not changing how the actual factory floor runs. It's actually changing how we can run the business processes that sit on top of those operational, not challenges, but operational opportunities that we have. So for us, a generative agent is something where the LLM, so let me backtrack a little bit. So we see a lot of it is about how can we automate these processes. And again, the big drivers for a lot of this is the systems are getting really complex. The machines that we're buying are getting really complex. So there's a cognitive burden, a cognitive overload on end users to be able to use that. They need to look at a number of screens. Somewhere in a water utility, a new operator needs to look at 16 screens. In a factory with the machines, it's even worse. There is a skills challenge, and it's not just people retiring, but it's also not keeping up to date with training because of how fast things are evolving. And then the last one is we're actually trying to reduce costs. So we're taking people and machines and things out of the equation. So in order to address those, we want to improve the business processes where a lot of the value gets generated in manufacturing and other industrial processes. So one of the ways to do it is just to have an automation, and inside that automation, I can put in an LLM and I can get it to help me do reports and inspection data and things like that just much faster. So there's an efficiency improvement. And we've seen it in many places, generating a specification which used to take 2 or 3 weeks for 2 or 3 engineers can now be done in 3 minutes. And the accuracy is pretty high. It's kind of as good as people. So that's kind of the automation side. What really excites us, though, is the ability to create a cognitive process, something where the agent can replicate the way that we make decisions. So it's about decision intelligence. And instead of engineering the process, which is what we always done, we can now engineer the decision and model that decision and then get the agents to take those decisions. And what sparked it for me was actually work that came out of Stanford about 18 months ago, where there was research done around how you can simulate the behavior of humans using large language models. And through that, there was a very similar to the OODA loop that a lot of people are familiar with, that come from the military, where it's observe, orient, decide, and act. In the Stanford model, it was about observe, reflect, plan, and act. And how can you use a large language model to do that? So for us, a real cognitive agent, and recently, a couple of weeks ago, there was another research paper that came out from all the top academic institutions combined, where they talk about these things as foundational agents. And they have this ability to not just curate and create content, but they can actually allow you to make cognitive decisions that through observations from its environment, being able to reflect on that, and then generating plans and actions and being able to adapt them in real time. So for us, it's a generative agent is one where there's an LLM that drives how the decision making in that agent work. And if you can put a few of them together and they can work together, that's where you can create these teams that work to an objective function or mathematical function that can now together observe, plan, reflect and act using a shared knowledge or a shared data space, a shared memory space and a shared decision space. So that's what is really hard to do if you trying to create either single agents or trying to do this with humans. We're not great at kind of storing kind of how all our decisions and things work together. So multi-agent or a multi-agent generative system is really a team of virtual workers driven by or powered by generative AI, and they also anticipatory, they're goal-seeking, they're always on, and they have this ability to do adaptive reasoning and make decisions on the fly and manage outcomes or processes, specifically business processes, towards an objective function.
Very good. We've moved into our topic here. Multi-agent generative systems. There's a new acronym here. I assume that you introduced that yourself, MAGS, MAX, I guess that's how you pronounce it probably. You said like putting a couple of these single generative agents together. So let's see, maybe it would be easiest if you could share with us, you know, an example of, you know, maybe a specific MAX, a specific multi-agent generative system that you as a company offer that's maybe operating somewhere, and you give us an example of what each of these agents in a system, what they do.
Yeah, I can give two quick examples. So the first one is, as I mentioned earlier, water utilities. So where you have, let's say, in a very remote area, struggling to get people to go and work there, there are reservoirs, large reservoirs that needs to be managed to be at a certain level. Now, that you can do with a control system. You don't really need AI or MAGS or things like that. But if you want to also, from a sustainability perspective, also reduce energy consumption and the cost of energy, you want to be able to pump those reservoirs when the electricity price is at its lowest. So in a market where you can buy electricity at different rates, there's an agent whose job it is to forecast what the best window is. There's an agent who looks at the levels of the reservoirs and deciding when to switch on the control system and when to switch it off, like a human operator would have done. So the machine switching on and off, that still happens in the control system, but making the decision on when that needs to happen, that's a reservoir operator who gets information and collaborates with the energy forecaster. Energy forecaster's objective is to try and reduce energy cost as well as improve sustainability metrics. And then there's a third agent who looks at the condition of the equipment, a predictive agent, and that agent is looking at when do I need to get time slots or maintenance slots, and I need to negotiate that with these other two agents, and what's the remaining useful life, all the classical things that you would see a reliability engineer do. Now, this is a very specific use case, so it's not all, well, when I say use case, this is a very specific task that these agents are doing. So they're not trying to do all the work of all the operators and all the engineers. It's just for this one set of pumps and water pumping and electricity for remote reservoirs where risk is low. So that's one example. The other one is in mining, where there are these big crushers that crush the rocks as they come out, and before you can get them on a conveyor, you have to crush them down. Now, this mining company got an engineer who used to look at these, and they've got liners like the brakes on your car. So over time, these liners would work. They would work down. You need to replace them, which takes about 2 weeks. And they've got six of these big machines. So there's almost like a factory with limited or constraints, very similar for them. So they've got these big six machines that crush the rock down. And the engineer would look at this to decide when to schedule the liner repairs. Now, operationally, they can run at full production with 5 out of 6. If they go to 4 out of 6, they have to throttle back production. So big losses on a daily basis. And he would look at those numbers. That person retired. We have built the models in the past around the prediction of when this is going to overlap, when we may have two of them at the same time, which we don't want. So it's really easy to take three agents now. It's one person with multiple tasks that they do. One of their tasks can be done now by these three agents. The one agent is a wear agent. The other one is the throughput agent. And the other one is also a maintenance agent. So between them, they decide and look at these crushers when they need to get relined, make sure them that we only have one at a time. But they work to a mathematical kind of objective function, so we can very easily see and track if they get this wrong. So those are two examples where they're both a team of three agents. We have teams of larger agents, six agents or so, where they're doing supply chain optimization, and one is looking at last mile logistics, while the other one is looking at some of the other logistics, so the demand planning on the factory, short-term inventory planning. So those are some of the examples of where these teams work together. And as you can see with the water example, there might be conflicting objectives. I may need a time slot. The window for the best energy is at this time, and the reservoir is too low. You know, so there might be three competing objectives, and these agents handle them.
I was going to ask you exactly you moved into that space of where I believe you differentiate between, I believe, what you call supervising agents and the lack thereof. Maybe you call it cooperative, I don't know. So, and maybe if, and you already kind of did that, comparing with the situation until yesterday, where, you know, exclusively humans were doing things. Can you make that comparison to situations where there was always like one manager in control and other people doing things as coordinated by the one person? And how do you see that to be taken over or supported, I don't know, by Max in the future, or already happening today?
I think there are also scenarios where you still have the humans in the loop. Certain tasks still needs to be done by a human. So it's actually a collaborative team. It's not just a fully automated. There are examples of the fully automated team. But there are also examples of where I still have humans who perform certain of the functions. In actual fact, one of the things that we're doing is we do a confidence level in every decision. So we work out a confidence level score that's based on a number of parameters. And if the confidence level is low, it will always still go to a human. So you need to build these, you need to create a safe operating envelope around these where you say, if you get too close to the boundaries of this, I still need to get it to a human. But to your point of having a kind of a directed team with a supervisor, we still also have some of those sometimes, not that often, where in a highly regulated industry like pharmaceuticals or something, there might be overseer or kind of a supervisor, and that role is more, some of the technical terms is like agent as a judge. So it will almost audit and check. And it's not really an orchestrator. Many of the other approaches that you see is this central hub and everything goes, the orchestrator will decide someone needs to research and get the research back, and then it goes to the writer and it comes back, and then it goes to that orchestration function. It's a very linear process. What we've created is the ability for agents to communicate with each other and then share their, and again, work to an objective, a mathematical kind of objective for the team and individually. And they can dynamically collaborate around a certain problem set, like the water one. So the three of them can actually come to a resolution. And there are ways that if we don't resolve, what are the consensus mechanisms? Like we do as humans. So sometimes we need a human supervisor.
I was going to say, yeah.
In terms of the behavior or the structure of this, we are trying to make it as closely resembling how human teams work. The only benefit that we have is we also have full traceability of how every decision was made by every agent in under what circumstances, which is really hard with humans. If you go back to a human, you ask him how they did it, it's sometimes harder. But
yeah, maybe typically one or three persons will in the end turn out to be the person making a final decision, or I don't know. Not sure that humans are so good at just sitting together. I mean, I think we're good at, and that depends a lot on the characteristics of the persons, of course, sitting at a table and doing things the three without knowing exactly who's going to make the final or whose job is to do what. I'm not sure.
And again, I think if you're managing, because I call them objective functions of mathematics, but it's really a set of KPIs. So everyone has got a KPI and there's a process KPI, and you can immediately see if the KPI is not achieved. And what we've seen and feedback that we've had from organizations doing this is it's not all the decisions are always better than your best human would have done it, but the consistency. So let's say I've got three shifts. Now I have the consistency of over three shifts where the night shift is not always better than the day shift. Or what we've heard from others in the supply chain logistics, my depot manager in this country and the depot manager in that country with the same data set will make two different decisions for the same data set. Now we've kind of, because we engineered the decision, we built a model around how we want the decision to work. We're getting much more consistent decisions, and we can also fine-tune them. But now we have it's just a more consistent and predictable operational situation that we have than, what is John going to do versus what Joe is going to do.
Sorry, that sounds like moving into an area I was going to ask you. Actually, there was a specific discussion we had at the Hanover Fair, and we talked about agents, and it was Boris Scharinger from Siemens, and he kind of questioned if agents would pass the certification process. Now, I do recall having read that, I believe you make the classification between, on one hand, maybe deterministic systems, and on the other hand, maybe non-deterministic, more emergent processes. Nevertheless, so the question is, like, how do you make sure that agents behave according to policies, company policies, rules, and regulatory requirements, like you just said, you mean more or less. How does that work?
I think that's one of the biggest questions that we see is, can we trust what agents are, and can we trust what agents do? Those are kind of the two things. So first of all, do we understand what they are, and then what do they do? So in terms of how do we make sure that they comply to kind of business rules. And I think the most important thing is to understand that large language models are not calculators. You know, they are generative and they predict the next token. And just because there's such a large body of training, they know, like we do, we also learn by what the next token is. So in order to reduce, first of all, hallucinations and things like that, grounding them in physics based. So get my sensor data, get real-time data. And before I pass it to the LLM, I'm not asking the LLM to predict when the pump's going to fail in that water thing. I'm actually running a traditional classical predictive model, a regression model, that's telling me when that pump's going to fail. I pass that on, and they just need to make a decision based on that grounded information. So grounding is really important in all of this. But the bigger challenge is, how do you do this at scale? So how do you make sure that every single one, because it's really easy to do POCs with little bits of code and let agents do interesting things. But how do you embed the business rules at a layer in the organization where you're sure that every single time that these things run, that they apply those rules? The way that we've approached it is we create what we call agent profiles. It's almost like the digital twin template of an agent. So let's say there's a maintenance agent profile. I can have 100 or 1,000 instances of it. It will inherit its business rules and what we call deontics. So the deontic rules are obligations, permissions, prohibitions. All of that comes from the profile. Now, when I have an instance, there might be local tasks and things that I wanted to do. I can never override what sits at the profile level. So I can never, even if I want to say do harm on my plant, it cannot do that because it's overriding deontics or the umbrella that sits over it, which is admin controlled and segregated. So there's that segregation of duties. That's one mechanism of doing it. Now, is it fail-safe?
That sounds like the Asimov robotics rules.
Yep, and you bake them in at that level where they are the governance levels, and it doesn't matter what you do at the lower level, you cannot override those governance ones. And they're both business rules as well as deontics. Deontics, again, more around it. Now, is that fail-safe? No. So what we've also done is kind of separated the ability to make a decision, that observe, reflect, plan, and act, really powerful. It's really smart. But that act is not really acting. It is just the intent to act. We've separated that from the ability to now physically go and switch something on and off. So that is, for us, that's kind of what we call data streams. So these agents sit on top of or live on top of kind of the digital twin or these real-time data streams. And if inside those streams that action is not available, you cannot do it. So if there's no way to switch something on or switch something off, even with all the intentions that the LLM may have to say go do this or do that, it physically cannot do it because there's that separation. So for us, that act, again, it's not really a full-on action. It is the intent to act. That intent is passed down into the next layer. And that layer is almost like a control layer. It's built on data pipelines and data flows with connectors, and you have full control over what actual actions can happen.
Can you share with us an example of what you call a data pipeline, data stream, maybe, you know, one that you are using at your company?
Yeah, so that's a great question because these agents are not built in isolation and organizations don't want to change tools halfway through because I now want to have some agents. So for us, a data pipeline is where I have, and we have about 200 different industrial connectors. I can, like a workflow, I can visually build them up from what we call listeners and content and context providers. So my real-time sensor data, my maintenance records, I can visually create that. It creates explainability as well. So I can now see I'm connecting to this source, that source, and I'm combining them, I'm cleaning some data, and I'm then passing that. And one of the things I may do is ground it. I run a predictive model. So the input, clean up the data, wrangle. We still do a lot of that because industrial data is not clean. Then pass it on to a predictive model. It will predict when this is likely to fail. And that endpoint is then passed to an agent. So that agent can then listen to this data stream, which is a visual workflow or a visual data flow. In this instance, can take millions of data points per day, runs through that, and that gets passed to the agent as an observation. If I didn't have agents, that could go to a dashboard. So classically, that would go to a dashboard that sits in front of an engineer. They would look at this dashboard and see when this pump is likely to fail. What we're now doing is we're taking that exact same data stream. So the only thing that we're adding is the block that says go to the agent and potentially still to the dashboard if you want to know what's going on. But now I can, now the agent has that information, does its processing, and when it's done and it's created that action, part of the output data stream, so back to the workflow or the data pipeline, is pick up that actually the actions that come out of it and then potentially create a work order in my work order management system, potentially switch things on and off if you allow them, or just send it as a recommendation. So that teams, all the work that they do could still go to a supervisor or a manager as a recommendation to say, we think you need to change the set point, and here's the evidence, and this is our reason. You can send that in Teams, for example, as a output of that workflow or that data flow. So most of these data pipelines are ingesting data from multiple sources, running some form of analytic, either passing it on to a human or passing it on to an agent. And then once that agent or human makes the decision on what they want to do with that, it generates the output or the act, we call them actions. So there could be a whole number of actions, send an email, update a blockchain records for me, initiate a smart contract, send it to Slack or Teams, or it really depends on what you want your business process. So that's kind of the new generation business process, is going from very deterministic, classical, going, you know, we converted paper to digital, that kind of business process, to a more high velocity, high volume, agentic style workflow, but still very visual. And I can fully explain every block, every step, and everything that goes through it.
Okay, what is the type of AI machine learning you already mentioned as an example, regression model, I believe. And as far as that is concerned, what is the reliability Python library that you use? And maybe one, two questions related to the way that you work. You work with technology partners, your customers work in the cloud, they can work local. How does that work?
Yeah, so again, if you work in the industrial space and then and things like critical infrastructure like water, airports, things like that, then sometimes they're limited in terms of what they can do in cloud and other. So our solution runs, we're agnostic to whether it's cloud or edge or a combination. So it could be a hybrid cloud edge solution where some of the data and some of the inferencing and things that you may want to do happens on premise. Other parts may happen in the cloud. Quite often, depending on the type of model that you're running, both from a kind of a classical AI as well as a generative AI, we determine where you would run, also the classification of your data and the privacy and all of those. Now, some customers in Europe, for example, can't run some of the providers because the data still gets processed in other territories, so data privacy. So for that reason, we are a Dell Validator design for manufacturing edge as well as the AI factory. We were on the Dell stand at Hanover Messe as well as the Distributech, where we showcased that. And again, it's either like just on the edge or in the cloud. It could be a hybrid that supports kind of the business process or where I need to do the grunt of the hard work on the AI models.
Very good. You started writing about this, and I assume that your thoughts, your ideas were actually even a long time before that, but almost like 3/4 of a year ago. Now, since what I see, only like a couple of months, everybody is talking agents, talking about the hype, and the hype always has the positive and the negative, the hype side. But how do you look at where we are today? I mean, assuming, just hearing, reading, that you must have been one of the drivers, at least in the industrial space. So what has happened since then, and where do you see that we are within the industrial space as far as the agents, multi-agents use in the industrial environment is concerned?
I think there's a lot of opportunity, but there's also a lot of confusion and risk. that we're seeing, because everyone is now talking about agents, or even the larger vendors and in the AI space, the generative AI vendors now have agents. And a lot of these are just automations. They're actually not, they don't have agency, but it's creating, and Gartner and others call this agent washing. So I think there's a lot of agent washing going on at the moment, where people are taking kind of old things, slap a little bit of LLM on it, and now it's becoming an agent. There are also other developments that happen outside of the industrial space, which is taking off like wildfire, and things like MCP or A2A. So MCP is the Model Context Protocol, which launched by Anthropic. Anything can connect to anything. We can't do that in a factory. We need to put that level of, now we support MCP inside our data stream. So again, as I mentioned earlier, I'm removing the intelligence of the agent to the execution of the data stream. In that, I can run an MCP if it's controlled under the governance of IT systems. But there's a lot of these things starting to emerge, agent-to-agent protocols. Now, they, in a way, they don't have the rigor that we have with something like MQTT or OPC UA or DDS, where we've had industrial protocols that do things at scale securely. So we're seeing a lot of that noise being introduced, and also we're seeing a lot of POCs being done, where someone thinks they can just quickly create a little bit of Python code and connect this thing to that thing, and that's done in a little bit of automation. So scaling out in industrials, I think there's a lot of risk that needs to be properly assessed when you're doing this, if you want to do this at scale in a secure and trustworthy way. And I think that's something we've spoken about from day one. So we've said you need agents that can observe, agents that can manage the process, but also agents that behave, and things like bounded autonomy. So hopefully we'll see more of that conversation on the industrial side, where we don't just go after the next bright, shiny thing, you know, can we connect anything to anything? But rather look at, first of all, what is the job that I'm hiring this agent to do? How can I do it in a trustworthy way? And how can I make sure that I'm getting ROI on it? And it's not just a kind of a play thing where it's creating a lot of technical debt for us over time.
Great. And for those listeners that want to hear more about MCP, maybe A2A, I did talk to Colin Mason from ARC 2 weeks back on that topic. So you can, I believe also for you listening, you can go back one or two episodes. Well, yeah, amazing. Tell us a little bit more about your team, Peter. Where are you based? I think you talked a little bit about the customers and the type of markets that you operate.
We started in Sydney, Australia, and we still have a large team here. We also have a large team in the US, and we have a smaller team out in the UK. So we cover those geographies through the US. We also do South America. We're predominantly in asset-intensive industries, oil and gas, mining, energy utilities, manufacturing, and process manufacturing. Those are the predominant areas. And then again, like utilities could be water and power, but it's really more asset intensive, process intensive industries where trustworthiness and those things are critical. And we work with tier one mining companies, oil and gas companies, power utilities, and we've got some large discrete manufacturing as well as process manufacturing customers. And we also have a number of professional services partners that support us, where we can't support all the clients on really good engineering as well as IT-based service partners.
Sounds great. Only mainland Europe is still lacking, I hear.
It's busy. It's busy happening. There's some work underway in Europe. Too early to talk about it, but there's some exciting stuff. And again, for us, it's about how do we make sure trustworthiness and all that. So working with some of the local cloud providers from a data sovereignty and all that. So that's all underway.
Very good. Let's come to a close, Peter. Where is all of this bringing us? I mean, I understand you're kind of in the middle of, you know, providing your multi-agent generative systems to your customers. So you're actually in operation mode. So what have you learned since, and what does that mean if you project it into, as far as you can look into the future, please? What is this technology going to be doing with us? What is the big chance? Where are the risks? And how, well, just to put it at a really high level, I mean, how is this going to make changes to our society?
I'm a big supporter of what is busy happening, but we must also realize not everyone is going to get there at the same time. And even for us, we still see a lot of people building decision support with dashboards, a large number of people doing that. There's some who are experimenting with co-pilots and assistants. So that is a next step. And then this multi-agent generative systems. At the moment, it's actually a smaller part, but it gives us the opportunity, especially with the large organizations, to make sure these things are robust and they work really well. And the only analogy I can give around where we're going with this is if you think about farmers many, many years ago, there was a person with an ox and a big plow and walking, and the skill was in how I could actually manage this plow and I could feed my family and lived in a one-bedroom house. Later on, we got a tractor and I could drive the tractor. So the skill from the plow, I needed to learn a new skill. I lived in a much bigger house. I could feed kind of part of the town, but my skill changed. The mechanical part became part of the being able to do the plow became part of the mechanical part of the tractor. I needed to learn a new skill. These days, farmers, they sit in the office. They have fleets of large agricultural tractors and things which use GPS and they manage them from there, so they don't even have the skill of driving that tractor anymore. As we start seeing agents taking over the role of monitoring and checking and making sure that my tractors and things are all working and this, you know, they all have diesel and which ones need to go for maintenance or whatever the case might be, and that scheduling being that taken over, the next generation of farmers are more around how do we manage our assets, how do we get to the best economic use of agriculture and make sure things are sustainable. So I do see us improving the quality of life for everyone by taking, because we have such a skills shortage and the systems are getting so complex, but we can apply our cognitive capabilities and skills to the more creative problems that we need to solve around sustainability and longevity of everything. So that's where I see it heading, but it's still a journey. It's going to have a few bumps along the road, but there are definitely organizations who are starting to see the benefit of doing that.
It's a great comparison, which makes me a little bit sad as well. I'm a big tractor fan, basically. Whenever I'm out here and I see typically young men, young women on these huge tractors, as you say, they're like huge machines, and maybe realizing, knowing that sooner or later, you know, they're going to be driving around autonomously. But at the same time, it's many times because it's a chance rather than because we don't have the people to be driving the tractors. And I think you're making that comparison with regards to the multi-agent systems.
No. And all I wanted to say is in every single time we've seen that we've actually improved the quality of life for everyone around us. Now, every single time we go through one of those transitions, yes, there are skills that are lost. But generally, as a society, we're better off.
That's a great close. Thank you very much, Peter. Listeners that want to get in touch with you can do so through LinkedIn or...
Yeah, absolutely. LinkedIn or through our website.
Yeah, we'll put them both in the show notes so your listener can go there and get the detailed information. Peter, thank you very much. Have a great day and good luck with all the things you're doing. Good luck with your company.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.